Okay. Warm welcome to everybody, and welcome to our new series of classes, Am Yisrael Chai. We're taking, and we're going to be taking, pride and chizuk and excitement and energy in these very, very difficult times for Klal Yisrael. And today, very conscious of the fact that, what's today's English date? The 23rd, I think, of January. Klal Yisrael lost, buried, said goodbye to no fewer than 24 heroes, all killed in the last 20, all killed the last day in Gaza. Hashem Yakum Tamam, here, let me just give them to you. Particularly important. I will say it's nice to welcome everybody tonight. Remember, this is a two-part evening, because after pizza, which will be hopefully here at 8 o'clock, there'll be classes this week from Rabbi Kesa and Rabbi Gottesman, and every week a different... a selection of classes to choose from. But the last time I gave a winter series of classes was a five-part series. It was really successful. Actually, we did it twice, once during the day and once in the evening. A series on faith and Judaism. Why do Jews believe what we believe? It was a great series, I seem to recall. And it was in January, February 2020. So it seemed to me that we didn't get such a big attendance for classes for the rest of the year. I can't really think why. But hopefully this class will not cause another pandemic, Bezrat Hashem. What I want to talk about tonight is Am Yisrael Chai, why the Jewish people exist. Jewish peoplehood and the notion of Am Yisrael is something that we take for granted. For most of us, it's something that we were born into. For some of us, something that we chose and embraced. And what it means to be Jewish, and more importantly, what it means to be part of the Jewish people, is a conversation that's a bit like asking fish what it's like to live underwater, or asking people who aren't fish what it's like to breathe or live on the surface of the planet. We take it for granted. I actually found myself today, not just the usual lethargy, in particular in a day like today, it's so hard to concentrate on anything else, but trying to make sense of something which is as organic to us, as inseparable to us as the air we breathe, is extremely difficult. So try to tease out a number of themes. And the reason why this is important is because right now we all feel a tremendous amount, not just of identification of Israel, but a tremendous sense of identification of peoplehood, of being Jewish, of being part of Am Yisrael, with a connection to our fellow Jews. It's something which everybody is feeling. We've been feeling it since October 7th, and we're going to carry on feeling it for the foreseeable future. The number of people that I've had conversations with just today on Twitter, these sheets were already full, so I didn't add it. But a random, some kind of political commentator, but basically secular Jew, said, since October 7th, our family has started doing Friday nights. We've now started doing Havdalah. We're doing more Jewish things than ever before. And this paradox that when we're under attack, we don't merely want to strike back, but we want to be proud. It reminds us that we are a proud people, that it's a privilege to be Jewish. We're part of something grand, something eternal, something magnificent. We get that there are people who detest the very nature of any kind of Judaism, of Jewish people, certainly any assertion of Jewish rights anywhere in this world, particularly in Eretz Yisrael. And we know that's because they're opposed to that which is good and beautiful and significant and eternal about our people. And I want to start off, actually we're going to start and end with two comments. One from sadly, and I could have made this entire lecture, and I nearly did, just Rabbi Sacks' speeches or talks or teachings, as you can imagine how much he spoke about this. But I want to begin and end with a quote by Rabbi Sacks, and also by an up-and-coming Jewish leader who really is, thank God, is already beginning to take the Jewish world by storm. It's somebody called Michal Biton, who was the leader of the downtown Minyan, actually knew Rabbi Sachs from his time at NYU. She spoke, Michal spoke at the rally in Washington, D.C. It's a fellow Sachs fellow along with my wife, an individual who's really, really emerging as a magnificent up-and-coming and already established Jewish leader. Rabbi Sachs writes, and many, many people, I imagine, of his age and generation have had the same experience. 1967, the Six-Day War, changed everything. Not just the victory of Israel, but the threats. People have told me how before they had internet, before they had even, you know, any kind of regularly accessible news, you used to have to listen to the news on the hour. People during the Six-Day War would go to Times Square and hear the news from Israel. Is there still a state of Israel? Has it been attacked? Is it still alive to survive? It brought Jewish people to a state of consciousness that had been, especially after the Holocaust, so incredibly dormant. And Rabbi Sachs himself had a moment like that in Cambridge, England, and he wrote, "It was then in 1967 that I knew that being Jewish was not something private and personal, but something collective and historical." And that is so often the way, I think, for all of us, that when we connect to Judaism, it's a connection to community and peoplehood. It's not a private path. In fact, people who try and practice Judaism, cut off from the people, estranged from what the people hold dear, or distant from the people, eventually, inevitably end up, by and large, failing. And often, as we've seen, a sense of being attacked, of a Jew somewhere in the world being threatened, attacked because they're Jewish, brings us, however paradoxically, to embrace Judaism. Because we understand that they're two sides of the same coin. It meant being part of an extended family, many of whose members I did not know, but to whom I nonetheless felt connected by bonds of kinship and responsibility. And in the aftermath of October 7th, Michal Biton, I wrote a piece, and it was titled, "The Pain You Are Feeling is Peoplehood." And for many, many people, and I'm going to say that excludes most of us, most of the regulars that link to our synagogue, for sure, the notion that Israel being under attack would suddenly not, of course, we are reeling with pain. But for many people, an unfamiliar pain. What does Israel mean to me? I disapprove of the Israeli government. I hate Bibi Netanyahu. I never go to the synagogue. I don't keep kosher. And this overwhelming pain people felt and still feel after October 7th, particularly when that pain was rejected, was not reciprocated, was clearly held out to be a difficult pain, a problematic pain, not a cause that people wanted to identify with, good people and other liberal movements wanted to identify in any way. And Michal Biton wrote this piece, "The Pain You Are Feeling is Peoplehood." And she wrote, "I cannot seem to shake off the sense that we've returned to Jewish history, to saying, b'chol dor v'dor, from generation to generation, they rise up against us. A teaching by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, known as the Rav, came to my mind that Shabbat." She's talking about Shabbat HaShachor, October 7th. "A piece of Torah that I've returned to every day since October 7th. It is about Jewish peoplehood. The pain I felt in that moment was for the Jewish people, and I knew many others would be feeling the same, perhaps for the first time so acutely." And she goes on to describe the particular teaching that Rabbi Soloveitchik, that she shared. But the idea that we have suddenly been reminded that we are all part of a people, that we feel we share the same fate, that what happened to Israel, that the news that 24 soldiers died 24 hours ago in Gaza is something that is unbearable, that it's just unbearable. And why do we feel that way? And what is this connection that binds us together? It's not necessarily language. It's certainly not familiarity. Is it family? Is it religious observance? Certainly not. I have no clue. I'm not in the slightest interested in knowing whether these were Orthodox, not religious or not, yeshiva students, Hezder or Chiloni. It's no difference whatsoever. There is a bond that binds the Jewish people together in an extraordinary and magnificent way. So what makes Judaism? What is the definition of Judaism? And when I say Judaism here and Am Yisrael, Jewish people, I'm deliberately interchanging, for very obvious reasons, those terms. Who are the Jewish people? What is a Jew? Who are the Jews? Any takers? Yes. So we are Jews who are descended of, say, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, particular line, or who have converted to Judaism. That's who gets to belong to Jewish people for sure. But it doesn't help define what is the substance of this nation. After all, there are, at this point, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have hundreds of millions of descendants who are not part of Am Yisrael. Yes, miss?
I would say Israel, the root of that, those who wrestle with God, those who work with God.
So there's an idea.
Through the Torah and prayer and ritual.
So there's an idea of a connection that Jews look at the world in a particular way. One of the things I want to say, and I'll take Micah's contribution in a second and other contributions, is that each one, particularly this class, is sort of a beginning, an introductory remark for all the coming classes. Because whether we look at next week, what is it that makes Judaism unique? What have we taught the world that the world would not know without us? Or a related question about, well, how come the Jewish people have survived? Why is Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, so important? What is our Jewish future? What is our vision for the future? All of those talks are introduced this evening. Not to say they're not standalone, because they all fit together. I like to think of it as a diamond with many facets. You can't separate out the different parts of Jewish peoplehood. They all go in together. But we're trying to define tonight, what is it? What are we? A religion? A family? Are we? Who is in? Who is out? Micah.
I take it from what God said to Abraham, you know, you're supposed to be a blessing to the...
So the definition of
righteousness.
So the definition of a Jew is somebody who's a blessing to humanity. What about my landlord? No, my landlord. My landlord is indeed a blessing to humanity for the point.
That's what our job is.
That's what our job is. Okay, and non-Jews are not allowed to be blessings to humanity. Touche. Okay. So, well, one second. So take Ron, and then we're going to go, because even though I prompted a discussion, I want to nonetheless. I'm doing the terrible thing of teaching the material as opposed to teaching the students or whatever it is you're supposed to do. But tonight I'm going to teach the material.
Not disagreeing with them, it's already. For me, it's a covenantal. It's, I don't like the word religion. It's covenant between people and God.
So indeed, as Ron points out, there is a... Judaism exists, the Jewish people exist in a relationship with God, in a conversation with God, in a series of, in a set of mutually binding obligations. We get to be part of that covenant if we don't convert into it by being born into it, but it is binding upon us necessarily. But, and of course, here again is a paradox. I was just reading a Jewish Review of Books, which just came out, and I got to the piece, and then I had to remember it was 7 o'clock, so I had to come upstairs, where Jimmy Carter said to Golda Meir, that, Jimmy Carter was a Bible teacher, and he said, you know, I've taught the Bible many, many times, and it seems to be the message of the Bible is when the leaders of Israel disobey the Almighty, then they get punished. So what about you secular Zionists? Why are, you know, I didn't get to read her answer, but Jews and Jewish people and our affinity, our love for Jews and Jewish people do not depend on the fact of they are observant, blessed, and we might disapprove of their actions. But if God forbid a million times we heard that we would be as devastated, goes without saying, we would be as devastated to hear, God forbid, of a terror attack that killed, lo aleinu, any number of Jews anywhere in the world, regardless of their religious, secular standing. And there's no question about it. So it's true, Jewish people are bound with the covenant, Ron, but at the same time, we are ultra respectful of Jews who do not apparently obey the part of the covenant. So let's go on. I want to point out in the course of this evening two paradoxes. Here's the first. We'll get to the second a bit later on. Of Sadia Gaon. Sadia Gaon, who was one of the first called Jewish philosophers, lived in 10th century, correct me if I'm wrong, Ilan, 9th century, 10th century, lived a long time ago in Baghdad. He was one of the first rabbis that dealt with other religions, with Islam and Christianity, and had to define Judaism in a way that made it distinct but could be understood in the outside world. So Rav Sadia Gaon said, our nation is a nation only by virtue of the Torah. The essence of what the Jewish people exist to do is to observe the Torah. When God does not give the Torah as an optional extra to the Avot, and the Imahot, to this day you cannot convert to Judaism. It's one of the things that many people think is very, very unfair. You cannot convert to Judaism without at least the intention, the willingness, the commitment to become observant, even though a secular Jew can have generations of secular Jews after them who are all entirely considered Jewish without qualms. The DNA, if you like, the programming language of the Jewish people is Judaism. We are a nation only by virtue of the Torah. That's what defines the Jewish people. Not by, and it is our religion. And clearly, a Jew who converts to another religion, God forbid, is no longer Jewish. Halachically, are they Jewish? They say that Cardinal, what was his name? Ratzinger in Paris would come to synagogue to say, he was the chief cardinal of Paris, he would come to shul and to say Kaddish. Don't they would make him part of the minyan? It's an interesting question. But a Jew, the limits of Jewish identity come at the point at which a person adopts another religion. Secular Jew is one thing. God forbid Jews for Jesus is something that none of us would consider remotely in any landscape whatsoever part of the organized Jewish community. And in fact, I'm not aware of a federation or Jewish organization in the most secular of parts of the country, anywhere in the world, that would consider Jews for Jesus or a missionizing or messianic Christians who call themselves Jews to be Jewish, a part of the Jewish community in any sense. We may not observe Judaism, but Judaism is the religion of Jews. And yet, here's the first paradox, notwithstanding what I just said about the notion of somebody who adopts another religion, as the, take your question one second, Reva, the Gemara tells us very clearly that a Jew has sinned, Yisrael, afal pi shechateh, Yisrael who? The definition, a Jew, even though they may sin, is still Jewish. The definition for many religions is somebody who practices their religion. The definition of a Christian is not somebody who is born to a Christian mother or parent or was once baptized. The definition of a Christian, functionally from a Christian religious point of view, is somebody who believes, practices that religion. If they don't, they're no longer considered to be a Christian. When it comes to Judaism, a person can come to shul precisely zero times a year. And yet, Chabad will fall over themselves to put tefillin on the guy if he's a man, or give her Shabbos candles if she's a woman, because we don't care whether somebody is observant or not. The point is that they ought to be. So Yisrael Afobi, you cannot leave Judaism. So we are ultimately, says classical Judaism, a people because of our religious commitments, and yet, even if we don't believe or practice any of them, we're still Jewish. And that's a huge paradox. Reva.
Okay. So, when it comes to a Jewish person going to convert to a different religion, does that mean that they have to, like, rescind their whole identity as a person who is Jewish?
According to Judaism, you cannot. If you were to do that, you would lose the, on some level, it would be considered to be an act of betrayal against the people, like becoming a traitor, a spy against your people. But it wouldn't mean that you would actually have, you can renounce your American citizenship. Sometimes people do that for tax reasons or for other reasons, whatever. You can't renounce your Jewish identity. Somebody who tries to leave Judaism will be punished by the God of Israel for doing that. And the Bible is very, very clear about that. So that's kind of paradox. So let's try and drill down into this question. Who are the Jewish people? Why do we exist? Why are we chosen? What were we chosen for? What binds us together? What sets us apart? What are our duties? Are we fundamentally responsible to each other? Are we fundamentally responsible for the rest of the world? Are we supposed to? Are we allowed to? Must we? May we prioritize ourselves? And if and when? And the story begins, as one or two of you have already pointed out, the very beginning, the chapter, the 12th chapter of the book of Bereshit, of Genesis. Parshat Bereshit and Parshat Noach, and we'll see how Rabbi Sacks treats this story, we'll see how Maharal of Prague treats this as well, treats this remarkable story. The first 11 chapters of the Bible tell a story about humanity. Adam and Eve and the aftermath of the Garden of Eden and the expulsion, and humanity till the time of Noah, and then the story of Noah and the flood and the Tower of Babel and the dispersion after that. And it's a story all about humanity. Was Noah Jewish?
No.
Yeah, I guess so. Was Adam Arishon Jewish? Some people are very uncomfortable saying he wasn't. And there is a school of thought, Hasidic, Kabbalistic, that of course he was. But of course, the Torah is not is telling a story, first of all of humanity. And then after the Tower of Babel, when all humanity tried to unite under one language, under one ideology, and one location, God dispersed mankind to right through the world, through the known world, let's say. And it splits off into many tribes and many nations and many languages. And then, without any kind of warning or context, we find the following verses. Vayomer Hashem el Avram. God says to Avram, Lech lecha me'artzcha. Leave, go from your land, umimoladcha, and from your birthplace, umibeit avicha, and from your father's house, to the land that I will show you. Avram is asked to go on a journey to an unknown land. That itself is very redolent of Jewish peoplehood, anticipates, foreshadows a lifetime of wandering, of going towards a destination. Ve'escha legoy gadol. I will make you into a nation. I will make you a nation. Va'avarecha, and I will bless you. Va'gadla shemecha, and I will make you famous. V'yeh bracha, and you will be a blessing. And right there in that second verse of Jewish peoplehood is described and can be unpacked many of the themes, some of which we'll talk about next week, others in future weeks as well, that the Jewish people will be a significant people. The Jewish people are a tiny people. How many Jews are alive today? Maybe 16, 17 million max, depending on how you count them.
1/4 of 1%.
Yeah, tiny number of people. As Rabbi Sacks used to say, the rounding error of a Chinese census is the Jewish people. And yet, and this is not an accident, this is almost anticipated here. What else does it mean? I will make you into a great nation, which doesn't necessarily mean not huge, but an important nation. And the Agadla Shemecha, I will make your name great. V'hiyeh bracha, you will be a blessing. You will be people of tremendous influence. The Jewish people are to make a difference, an impact. And this is this notion. Avram is plucked. The Torah, there is, and we'll see this in a moment, there is no real backstory. We're told his father had maybe started the journey. There is nothing the Torah tells us about Avram. No act of heroism, no act of righteousness, no act of courage or principle belief. That is all left for extrapolation from commentators, etc. The Torah identifies an individual and says that he will change the face of the world by becoming a nation of tremendous significance. And I will bless those who bless you. And I will curse those who curse you. What does that tell us? How much time do you think? I mean, I would have more reason than you. How much time do you seriously spend thinking about the French on most days? Even me, I've sort of really, scaled it down to no more than a couple of hours a day of seething this. We don't normally, this notion of God says to Avram, I will bless those who, you will be a polarizing figure. There will be people who will bless you, and I will bless them. And there will be people who will curse you. Why would anybody ever want to curse Avram? What did he ever do to anybody? He was the nicest person. Talking about him and his descendants. You will have enemies. It will be inevitable. Partly because you'll be different and people resent people who are different. And partly because you will carry a message that will make many people angry and resentful. Because it's my message to humanity. And there will be people who will do anything to stop you spread, who will be obsessed. And even though you will be distinct, you will be, as Micah said, a source of blessing to all the families of the world. And that's, by the way, such a beautiful expression, Kol Mishpachat Adama. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So here you already have a people, Avram, a person, who's being promised to become a nation. The nation will have an impact. The nation will become famous. The nation will have supporters and detractors. And God promises to stand with Avram, and that his mission is not entirely a selfish mission. Or his mission is not a selfish mission. His mission is to bring blessing to all the families of the earth. Yes. So we'll actually, they regard him as a prophet, but we'll talk about the net. And I think what you're putting your finger on is this notion of, is Judaism a belief system or is it a family? And we need to unpack that, and we'll get to that in a little bit later on. What are the other elements of this peoplehood? God tells Abram, go to a land that I will show you. And I will make you into this very significant nation that will have a fame and over influence over the entire world. There are more elements as well. And notice, by the way, even though Avram calls out in the name of God, he's a believer of God, the contours, the content of what Jewish faith is are not spelled out in the book of Bereshit, or for that matter, barely spelled out in the entire Chumash. Chumash is not really a book about belief per se, and certainly Avram's faith is assumed rather than described. What are the other elements of, therefore, of what goes into making up this people? So a little later on in Parshas Lech Lecha in Bereshit 15, Hashem says to Avram, and he says this in a number of places, Bayomahu karat Hashem et Avram brit lemor. God made a covenant with Avram, saying, Lizaracha natati et haaretz hazot. To your descendants I have given this land, Minahar Mitzrayim ad Nahar Hagadol Nahar Parat. From the river to the other river. And it's quite a lot of, that's more than the river to the sea, to be honest. The Jordan River is not even mentioned here. From the Nile to the Euphrates, the biblical borders of the land of Israel is, no suggestion here, certainly not in the book of Bereshit, that nobody else is allowed to live there. But this is the land that God has designated for the Jewish people from the Nahar Mitzrayim at the Nahar Gadol, Nahar Parat. So land, territory, God gives to Avram and his descendants. It is a promise that is far more made than kept. The paradox is, for the entire five books of Moses, the Jewish people will never own the land of Israel. Avram in his lifetime, neither did Yitzchak or Yaakov have sovereignty, control over the land of Israel. It is the promised land, as some people put it, the much promised land, the often promised land. But it is the land given to the Jewish people. So there's territory. We will have a home. But Samson Raphael Hirsch writes, we may touch on this next week, the land of Israel is a land given to the Jewish people precisely because of its physical location between the continents of Africa, Asia, and Europe. It is the crossroads of humanity. It is a place where a small people with a unique set of ideas will be able to be maximally exposed both to invaders and their both in terms of climate and strategic land. It's a difficult place to hold. To no small extent, they require God's constant intervention and approval to live there, meaning that if they mess up, they'll be exiled. But it's also a place of tremendous opportunities. So that's the second element. The third element, of course, it's at Har Sinai. We'll read about this in next week. No, this coming week, the week after the Torah portion. The Torah is given. And before Hashem gives the Torah to the Jewish people, he says, V'yatai im shamoa tishmu b'koli. If you listen to my voice, u'shmartem et briti, and you guard my covenant, v'yitem li skula mikol amim. You will be a treasured nation. Am skula is a phrase from a later book of the Bible. But you will be skula, you will be treasure. Kili chol ha'aret. I own the entire world. You are my choicest possession. Ve'atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You will be a nation of priests, or a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Eile dvarim asher didabero b'nei Yisrael. The Jewish people are to be given this choice possession of Torah, made responsible for keeping this Torah, and be elevated in with all of these words that refer to distinction. Priesthood, kingship, skula, treasure. There is a unique and qualitative elevation of the Jewish people. And the last feature, at least for our purposes, of the Jewish people is, and it's something that we feel that we both get strength over tremendously, that is a nightmare that, God forbid, should turn out not to be true. And that's the eternity of the Jewish people. The eternity of the Jewish people. That even though we have been, and we'll certainly have a whole class based on this, even though we have been through what we have been through, and not just that we are going through what we're going through, but that the enemies of Israel are determined to make a, you know, when will Hamas make peace with Israel? Here we have Yudit Barsky in the room. Yudit, when will Hamas make peace with Israel? Never. That's the answer. Never. Don't think that, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have, you know, to go, whatever, I see that build a better wall or Iron Dome with the lasers. But when will they be reconciled to the fact that we live too? That we're also here. And particularly there. When? Never. Don't think. What? Never. I saw an interesting Facebook exchange between some Egyptian neurologist and our own Edmund Haddad. That's the magic of social media. Total strangers can have arguments. But they will never, ever accept our existence. They won't. Which means that when will we have to fight until Mashiach comes? And when might that be? Long time. Could be a long time. Could be now. Might not be now. And that's scary. That is scary. And what if they win? And the answer is, they won't win. They won't win. How do we know they won't win? It is possible, but it's also impossible, because Hashem promises. How do we know that's right? Well, they've tried so many times before. Behold, dor v'dor omdim aleinu. And this is the last element. I just want to say the very, very end of the book of Vayikra, almost the very end of the book of Vayikra, Parshat Bechukotai, when the first set of curses are given, and God says, you're going to sin, and I'm going to throw you out of the land of Israel with the fury that is going to be astonishing, and I'm going to turn your land desolate and exile and send you all away. And even then, Va'af gamzot be'yotam be'eret oyveham, even when you are completely exiled, lo ma'astim ve'lo ga'altim l'chalotam, I will not, nonetheless, I will never totally reject you to destroy you, la'hafer briti itam, I will never break my covenant. Ki ani Hashem Elokechem, I am the Lord your God. V'zacharti lahem brit rishonim asher hotzeiti otam me'eretz Yisrael, l'ini ha'goyim, liot lahem l'Elohim, ani Hashem. I will bring you back to the land of Israel, I will remember the covenant. These are promises from the rock of Israel, that we will never be destroyed. Sounds like an important point, so let me take it.
I'm sorry, Rabbi. I happen to agree with you. You said Hamas will never make peace. But I want to hear your answers to why you believe that they will never make peace.
This is not born out of prejudice. It's not born out of a sense that I happen not to like Gentiles. It's not born out of that at all, because that's what they say. We will have a class on anti-Semitism, the hatred of the Jews and the survival of the Jewish people. But I will point out to you that just like, imagine what the Gaza Strip could have been today with those billions of dollars of aid that pours in. It's like, and it's actually, in many ways, it's actually worse. The Nazis, you know, they diverted, you know, vital resources to their war effort. 1944, 1945, they made a conscious decision to kill the Jews of Europe, of Hungary, and take them to Auschwitz with precious resources and train tracks and infrastructure, rather than pursuing the war. Hamas have done the same thing, only worse, only for years under deception, and we've let them, and they have built this terror infrastructure. They have thrown their future into every chance and possibility they've had for peace into building a war machine, and it is insane from any rational point of view. Now let's go on page 3. Let's talk about paradox number 2. Paradox number 1 was the fact that on the one hand the Jewish people are people defined by its religion, the Torah, according to our Tzadiyah God. But the other hand, you're still Jewish even if you don't keep any, not just if you occasionally sin, but if you don't keep any of the Torah at all. Sometime in the 12th century, Maimonides was asked the question by an individual called Avadia the Ger. How did he get the name? So Avadia was a convert. And some people were quite mean to him. And one day in shul, they said to him, you don't get to say the prayers. Maybe Avadia had yahrzeit or something. He was davening. He was saying the blessings aloud. You don't get to say the prayers like the rest of us say. Elokeinu, Elokei Avoteinu, Elokei Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. You can't call Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob your ancestors because they're not your ancestors. You're a convert. You can't say Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Amin because you're a convert. You have to keep the mitzvahs, but you're not actually related to us. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are not your patriarchs and matriarchs. And this upset Avadia very much. And he wrote to Maimonides. And the Rambam answered him with tremendous compassion and tremendous conviction. This is just a small excerpt from the letter. And he writes as follows. Yes, you may say all of this in the prescribed order, not change it in the least. In the same way as every Jew by birth says his blessings and prayers, you too shall bless and pray alike, whether you are alone or pray in the congregation. The reason for this is that Abraham our father taught the people, opened their minds, revealed to them the true faith and the unity of God. He rejected the idols and abolished their adoration, their worship, etc. Ever since then, whoever adopts Judaism and confesses the unity of the divine name, as it is prescribed in the Torah, is counted amongst the disciples of Abraham our father. Peace be with them. Thus Abraham our father, Abraham Avinu, peace be with him, is the father of the pious posterity, of a pious posterity keeps his ways, and the father of his disciples and all proselytes who adopt Judaism. Doesn't make any difference whether you are converted into Judaism or you are born into Judaism. You are Jewish like anybody else, And it's not just the fact. No, the truth is, if you study the last chapter of Masechet Kiddushin, as we did recently in Daf Yomi, etc., so some of them more common. There was times when Jewish people were very picky, very chauvinistic about yichuds and lineage, but there's no question about it. The Rambam, of course, is 1,000% correct that it makes no difference whether you converted into Judaism, you were born into Judaism, you practice Judaism in the same way, that is to say, you relate to the story of the Jewish people as your story. Because conversion into Judaism is about being absorbed into the peoplehood. And the Rambam's point is that Avram was both parent and teacher. Parent to some, for our purposes Yitzchak, and teacher to many. To many people who came under his spell and his tutelage. And yet, and this sort of answers the question we had before, and I actually spoke about this in Shul the other week, about Kel Shakai, the God who is sufficient for us. When God, and this is a rabbinic tradition, when God tells, but certainly something happens. At a certain point in his life, you see this in Parshas Lech Lecha, in the beginning of Vayera, Abraham has a huge amount of followers. What happened to the followers of Abraham? Where are they? They didn't become Muslims or Christians. What happened to the followers of Avram and Yitzchak? The Jewish story, the story of the rest of the book of Bereshit, is a story about the family of Abraham, about Isaac and then Jacob and then the tribes and the nation of Israel. What happens to everybody else? So they apparently are monotheists, but they're not part of the people. If they were, we would be a massive people of billions of people. And according to rabbinic tradition, when God tells Avram to circumcise himself, Avram says, and I quoted this in Shul the other week, Avram says to God, oh, that's crazy. Sorry, excuse me, God, but that's crazy. Why would I want to do that? That's the most unpopular thing that you could possibly, you know, nobody is going to want to be part of the Jewish people if it requires circumcision. Certainly not many people will be. So you're telling me that we're going to take this amazing strategy of winning converts and we're going to suddenly turn them all away. That makes no sense whatsoever. And God says that's the way it's got to be. And that's kind of this part of it, because as the Rambam points out, that not only are converts welcomed, but Avram has two missions of bringing up children, and really he only has Yitzchak, the covenantal child, but he also teaches many, many people. So anybody who converts can call themselves a descendant of Avram in that sense. But yet, at a certain point and early, Judaism becomes about a family and not about a movement. It is not an ideology. We do not say all those who believe in monotheism, all those who believe in our way of life, all those who believe in protesting evil are ipso facto parts of the Jewish people wherever they may. We do not say that. There's a family component, a tribal element, open, sometimes reluctantly, sometimes not, to conversion, but essentially a family based around a set of ideas. Second paradox, we're open to conversion, but we're not a proselytizing religion at all. It's belief in a universal truth. God is the maker of everything, and all human beings are answerable to him. But it's a religion for the Jewish people. So in the last few minutes left, and I don't want to go much over our time, let's try and answer the central question. And I want to spend a few minutes explaining an extremely profound answer that Rabbi Sacks, Zichroni Livracha, gives. Before to do that, I actually want to show how, looking at the same set of facts, Maharal of Prague gave many hundreds of years earlier the opposite answer. Both Maharal of Prague and Rabbi Sacks look at, as we saw before, the opening of Parshas Lech Lecha, the beginning of the Jewish story, and note that it happens without context. There is no reason given why Avram should be chosen and why his descendants should be the Jewish people, the chosen people. And the Maharal of Prague, a profoundly important 16th, long time ago, European scholar. When did the Maharal live? The 1600s? 1500s? So the Maharal of Prague, there's a whole system of sort of mystically based Judaism. And he says, and I'm going to read these Hebrew, we're in the Beit Midrash, this is a shir, a class to a certain extent. Let's look at these Hebrew lines on the and towards the bottom of page 3. He says, Aval Fiat Devarim, and he writes at great length and somewhat repetitiously, Aval Fiat Devarim Ashar Marnu Lecha Lo Yikash Klal. On the bottom of page 3, this Hebrew line is the bottom of page 3. Ki Etzel Noach Lo Hayarak Bechira Prati. Why is Noach chosen to save humanity? Because the Torah tells us, Noach Ish Tzadik, Tamim Hayah B'dorotav, Noach Matzachen, that Noach was a righteous individual. So Noach was chosen as an individual. And the Torah tells us why. Babachira hapratit hu lefi mashahu. And he was chosen because of who he was. Vakol hu lefi masa tzidkat shalom. Because he was righteous. Avav Avram lo haya bechira pratit. The reason why the Torah doesn't tell us why God chose Avram was because God did not choose Abraham. This is what the Maharal says. God did not choose Abraham. Who did he choose? The Jewish people. Rag ba'uma Yisrael shehem zaro. And the Maharal has a mystical answer. You find it to a certain extent anticipated in Kuzari. You see it a lot in following that in Chabad teachings and other Hasidic teachings. That there is something different about the Jewish people. There's something intrinsically holy about the Jewish people. We are the descendants of Avram. According to the Maharal, it's not that we have all these traits some or other preceded Avram. Whoever the Jewish people are from the beginning of time, and were called Reshit, the very beginning, the first, they were marked out as special. We are chosen because we are Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael is different. It's not because Avram, as many other writers will say, Avram was courageous, Avram was a counterclass, Avram was one who discovered God. Avram discovered God at the age of 40, say some, and the age of 3, say, nothing to do with that. Avram happened to be the first Jew, but we're not Jewish because of Avram. Jewish because of a trait of intrinsic holiness. Why did God choose the Jewish people? So the Maharal says, because the world depends on Torah. The most important force in the universe is Torah. Now, these are mystical ideas that normally, at least I don't normally teach. They sound strange coming from me. I say, no, they sound strange to many of our ears. But it's important to understand how mainstream and critically important these ideas are in many, many, many parts of Judaism. And again, not chauvinistic, not necessarily chauvinistic at all, but the Torah is elemental. God created the world and not as an afterthought decided to give the Torah. The Torah, God's rules for humanity, are given to the Jewish people because the world would not exist without the Torah. There is only one nation on earth who could keep the Torah, the Jewish people. And that explains this whole Midrash, that if God says to the Jewish people, if you don't accept the Torah, then I'm going to have to just destroy the world because there is no world without Torah. So there's this idea, and it's important to understand how it lingers in many, many parts of mystical and even modern theology, that there is something set apart from the very, very, very beginning about Judaism that is just distinct and different. That doesn't reflect the rest of the sources I've undershaped, but it's certainly very, very important. And by the way, this notion, and therefore what is the role of the Jewish people? The role of the Jewish people is to keep the Torah. What about the rest of humanity? So you might think, well, and there are ideologies that really downplay the role of the rest of humanity, but don't forget the opening verses of Jewish peoplehood. We will be a blessing. We will be a blessing, a mishpachan, or legoyim, it's said elsewhere as well, a light unto the nations, etc. So the Rambam, and by the way, this is completely out of context. This is from a Rosh Hashanah speech, if you like. This is the kind of talk that I've taught a million times before Rosh Hashanah, not a million times, a slight exaggeration. But Maimonides tells us that whenever a person does a mitzvah, the world is like a set of scales. Remember that? We learned about it in school. The world is a set of scales, and if you do a mitzvah, you push the world, you put your cheshbon and the cheshbon of the whole world to the side of good. And if you do an avera, a sin, you push your... What the Rambam is really saying is that every time a Jewish person does a mitzvah, they bring, and he uses the phrase, bracha v'hatzala, into the world. They bring blessing, reward, spiritual energy, divine protection into the world. The ultra-rationalist Maimonides and the mystic Maharal, the particularistic Maharal, find common ground in this idea that humanity benefits when Jewish people keep the Torah. That's not necessarily to say that our job is to teach the world the Torah, but our responsibility is to keep Torah so that the world exists. That is a very authentic Jewish idea. And I'm going to say there are times, and God forbid, we should live in such times, but it is easily foreseeable that we will, that we'll be thrown back into extremely particularistic texts and ways of looking at the world because of our disgust of the way that humanity looks at us. That is entirely, entirely both, you know, understandable and, God forbid, even predictable. So this notion that we keep the world going and the world isn't even grateful. On a different level, Sforno, and here I'm saying this kind of outside of the sheets, the Sforno says that before Har Sinai, the Jewish people are told, you are going to be a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. What is a kingdom of priests? Are there any kohanim in the room? Joe? A kohen? Any other kohanim? So we're not doing Kriyat Torah right now, but is a Kohen superior to the rest of us? Joe? Oh, you're supposed to say, yeah, if you're proud, be a proud Kohen. If Edmund Kohen, Oliver Sholem was here, what would he say? Yeah, of course. What are you talking about? Of course. So, what is a Kohen? A Kohen is somebody who is separated from the people, in order to have a spiritual role to benefit the people. And Sforno says that's why God very particularly uses this phrase before Har Sinai, a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. Just like the kohanim are part of the Jewish people, but they have a special role to serve God in a way that not everybody can. Otherwise, there would be no farming and no working, etc. Kohanim have other duties. Just like kohanim are part of the people, but have a role to help the rest of the people in serving God, that's the role of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are the kohanim of the world. It's part of the world, but also distinct with special responsibilities for the spiritual benefit of all humanity. So separate, but responsible. And many, many texts, almost every understanding of Jewish peoplehood gets involved in this question. Because the question becomes, how can the first 11 chapters of the book of Bereishit deal with all humanity? And then suddenly, the Bible isn't. You know, I read a lot of history books. Right now, I've just started reading. I mentioned in this class this morning, Simon Sebag Montefiore's book, The World. It's about 1,600 pages long. I'm only going to ever read it on Shabbos. And I can read about a paragraph before I fall asleep. So I will almost certainly never finish this book. But it doesn't matter, because when you buy modern history books, I'm old enough to remember when history books were about, you know, Europe and then America. And then, nowadays, all these, you know, even world histories, they have to be all about, you know, China and Asia and stuff like that. You know, that world history books were never used to, when you were a kid, they never used to talk about China and stuff. But now you have to acknowledge that the world is a big place and there's lots of empires, etc. So, the book of Bereishit is not a book like that. It doesn't keep telling you what's happening in the other parts of the world. Meanwhile, the Ming Dynasty, you know, they're all at war with each other. It doesn't talk. Once it starts talking about the Jewish people, it never stops. The rest of the Bible is about the Jewish people. So what does that mean? Does it mean, as some people say, after the Garden of Eden and after the flood and after the Tower of Babel and after all of this idolatry and after all this misbehavior of general moral decline, God gave up on humanity and chose the one saving grace, the Jewish people, and we're the only ones he cares about. There are people who say that, but that's not what the Bible says. So what is the role of the... So almost every theory of Judaism and Jewish peoplehood has to deal with this very, very question. So look and see what Rabbi Sacks says. Rabbi Sacks, and I have a... This is the bottom of page 4. Rabbi Sacks makes this point in a number of places. He actually wrote an entire book about it called Dignity of Difference. But he already anticipated this point, and indeed that phrase, in much, much earlier in his writing, many, many decades ago. And he maintained that the Jewish people are chosen by God for a very particular reason why God chose them, and for a very particular mission. And he writes as follows. This is actually extracts from a transcript of a lecture. The theme of the Bible, obviously, the second half of page 4. The theme of the Bible, obviously, is the story of the Jewish people, the children of Abraham and Sarah, the people of the covenant, the people whose name is Israel. It is about a particular people, one people in particular. However, as you know, the Bible doesn't begin there. How does it begin? It begins with an anomaly, a thing that doesn't seem to make any sense if we're trying to tell the story of one particular family. It begins not with the people in particular, but with humanity as a whole. It begins with those archetypal characters of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Noah and the flood, Babel and its builders. So what I'm telling you here is the second point. Judaism is telling us something very profound, that as we move from the universal to the particular, from things in general to this thing, this person, we're moving from the inhuman to the human. What Rabbi Sacks points out is that there's something illogical about the Bible, because you would expect it to be a story that would start off with an individual and then go on to make a point about everybody, that the individual story would become a universal story. But it's actually the opposite. The story of all mankind becomes a story of the Jewish people in particular. So the Bible goes from being a story about everybody to a story about one people, a particular story. Why is that? Because Rabbi Sacks says one of the most dangerous ideas in the world is that universal truths, even the universal existence of God, demand that we all become the same. That this sort of, this concept that since I know God exists, therefore you must worship him the way I do, is obviously the way that most religions work and brings violence and intolerance into the world. And Judaism says the opposite. We agree that there is one God. God is the God of all humanity. But he does not expect us all to worship him the same way. And that's an axiom of the Torah. Because if God is giving the Torah to the Jewish people, there are two options. One is, he doesn't care about the rest of humanity. Or the other option is, he cares about the rest of humanity, he just doesn't need them to keep the Torah. Which implies, therefore, that other people have their own past and relationships with God. And Rabbi Sacks says the fact that the Torah starts off as a universal book and then becomes a particular book is an invitation for humanity to create its own culture. Judaism is telling us something very profound. As we move from the universal to particular, from things in general to this thing, this person, we're moving from the inhuman to the human, from the impersonal to the personal, from the world of science to the world of humanity. If this is true, then God must love not universally but particularly. The thing that makes you different from me in our faith different from someone else's faith. The world, and then he goes on to, and I didn't do that point particular justice, but we're almost out of time. So let me just go on. Why the Jewish people? So Maharal of Prague says, because the Jewish people were just different, spiritually, genetically, DNA different from the creation of the universe. Other people have different theories. Rabbi Sacks says something very, very cogent. The world chooses the strong. And one of the paradoxes of our time, of course, is that for so many and for so long, and we have studied Judaism in the context of powerlessness. It's an interesting question about whether texts like this still resonate. Because Judaism starts off with a small nation who are kicked around. And then that leads to a nation that is kicked around. And is that the definition of the Jewish people? To be small and weak and vulnerable. Is that our, that might be our, you know, there are many, many people in Israel who are quite rightly horrified by that idea. But that might be the message of the Jewish people, at least for the last few thousand years. The world chooses the strong. God in his wisdom knew. He chose the people who knew themselves. The law b'chav, the law b'koach, ki'im baruchi. God picked people who understood that physical prowess and violence and might is not what is important in this world. That we don't survive on strength or power, but by God's Spirit. I have to tell you, it says in the Torah, Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generation. Noah walked with God. We know why God chose Noah. None of those words are used in the context of Abraham. None of them. As we saw before, like the Maharal said, the Torah does not tell us why God chose Abraham. God chooses whom the world rejects. He chooses the marginal, the nomads, the few, the young. Next week, we will see how so many Jewish teachings are polemics or subvert the notion that power obviously buys you rights over other people, that wealth and power and privilege make you better than other people. Judaism completely overturns through law, through Torah, that assumption that all humanity had and many still have. People who wither in their own land from then to today to live in Israel to live. People who wither in their own land from then to today to live in Israel is that's something wrong there? Is to live in a tiny country surrounded by big empires at the juncture of three continents. Israel always was a tiny people surrounded by big neighbors. What God chose Avram was because Avram was a person who apparently stood up to tyranny, was not afraid to express his beliefs in God, even when it was dangerous to do so, and God chose him to perpetuate that idea that he doesn't choose power, he actually chose those who the world rejects. Secondly, in the dispersion, we were a minority, disempowered and scattered throughout the world. It is the people who are vulnerable who are exposed to are at risk. On them, God shows his special love. That is why the treatment of the Jews in history has always been a litmus test of the humanity of any age. It is why the Jewish story has always been a great narrative of hope, because it is the story. And that is why it spoke to the founding fathers of America who were trying to set up something against the British. Why it spoke to the black civil rights activists who were trying to create a space for themselves in America. But because the Jewish story was always of a people who were vulnerable, small, weak, exposed, afraid, and yet who never lost hope, and as a result, never ceased to be. And I think now, and I really am over time, but I think now we understand this implicitly and viscerally, that our story, and don't let the world, and I will say one more kind of political comment, the narrative created the world is that mighty Israel, the mighty IDF, is pounding the poor, defenseless Gaza. The narrative of the world really is how Iran and hundreds of millions of, and there's this opposition of countries and hatred to Israel that will not be reconciled to the existence, who barely can tolerate the existence of a Jewish people, certainly not a Jewish state, under any terms or any circumstances. This is this notion that Jewish people are a triumph of survival, despite the fact that they are perpetually, by definition, smaller and weak. Yes, we have to defend ourselves, but always, it will always be at immensely unfavorable odds, and that's what gives us just, pride is the wrong word, which astonishes us into reverent silence of what it means for the survival of the Jewish people. And look at this last quote by Rabbi Sacks. The other quote from Michal Biton I will leave till Shabbat. The very last bottom of the page here, on page 5. Uniquely, Jews are born into a faith. It chooses us before we choose it. You don't get to opt out. Physically, we come naked into the world. But spiritually, we come with a gift. The story of our past, of our parents and theirs throughout almost 40 centuries from the day Abram and Sarah first heard the call of God and began their journey to a land, a promise, a destiny, and a vocation. That story is ours. It's our story. It's a story we're still living. It's an incredible story. It's a story of triumph. It's a story of triumph over hatred. It's a story of the triumph of hope over despair. It's a triumph of people trying to destroy us, and just the fact that God will not let them, and we will never, 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 never give in. So that's the first of our attempts to try and explain what it is that we are so proud of to be Jews. I'm Yisrael Chai. Next week.